as a proud grandparent of two grandchildren, Lori and I have the almost golden opportunity to watch a child's development, objectively this time. Someone said to me just this week, when you're younger, you're just trying to stay alive. The second time around, you see things. And with a hindsight advantage, you can see where things are going. And you can say occasionally to your spouse, the teen years are going to be a bear. You can watch their personalities open like a flower. But inside of every personality is a will, a deep, abiding sense of self-determination. And despite how cute children are, if you ever cross that will, you will pay. Recently, I saw an article written by a lawyer called Property Law for Toddlers. If I like it, it's mine. If it's in my hand, it's mine. If I can take it from you, it's mine. If I had it a while ago, it's mine. If it's mine, it must never appear in any way to be yours. If I'm doing something or building something, all of the pieces are mine. If I saw it first, it's mine. If I can see it at all, it's mine. If I think it's mine, it's mine. If you don't stop me from playing with it, it's mine. If you tell me I can play with it, it's mine. If it will upset me too much when you take it away, it's mine. If I think I can play with it better than you can, it's mine. If you're playing with something and you put it down, it's mine. If it's broken, it's yours. No, wait, all of the pieces are mine. How many of you raised children with that predilection? What is remarkable is how resilient and adaptive that is. We carry it with us in so many ways throughout our entire lives. It just looks different. It's more subtle, more sophisticated, but it's still there. And what is remarkable to me is how little getting saved has to do with any of this. What I mean is, you can become a Christian and still have that. Part of our problem with evangelism is that it never confronts the self. It simply baptizes neuroses. Without ever confronting it and calling for a change. You can take this with you, this obsession with self, into the first conversion, even into the second conversion, but you must deal with it in the third conversion. In the first conversion, you need curiosity. In the second, you need to take a risk. In the third, you need self-denial. And self-denial is not lowering yourself or berating yourself. Self-denial is losing yourself or surrendering yourself to something bigger than yourself. I don't know how many people I have prayed with or talked to trying to cast out the self. But the self cannot cast out self. The self can only surrender and give itself to something else. That's how we put it in its place. So self-denial is recklessly throwing yourself into something bigger than yourself until you come to forget yourself. And your entire life becomes the pursuit of something outside of you, something bigger than you. But as I say, this is a highly adaptive and resilient problem. Such that I think the only thing that can deal with this is another conversion. And this conversion is hard. It comes through great struggle. There's a war that typically goes on inside of you when God is trying to do this conversion with you, and you by nature resist it, you fight it, you try to negotiate with it, you call God names, you shout, you protest, you do something to make God pay a little hell. But if you will stay with him, he will convert you. You'll come through it. For Peter, this happened in Caesarea Philippi. And the place is not lost on us, is it? Caesarea Philippi is an outpost for the Roman military. It's a summer home for the Caesar. Caesarea Philippi is a city in Jesus' day that is lined with monuments or vestiges of Roman authority. This is important because what Jesus is about to say will fly in the teeth of everything around him. You must picture yourself really standing in something like the Mall in Washington, D.C. You are surrounded by vestiges of American conquest and government. And here in the shadow of the empire, Jesus proclaims another way. It is here under the empire, Jesus says to his disciples, who do people say that I am? Well, they say, some say John the Baptist, some say Jeremiah, some say Elijah, maybe you're one of the prophets. Then it's emphatic in Greek. Jesus says, but you, who do you say that I am? Peter doesn't wait. Peter says, you are the Christ. You are the anointed one, the favored one of God. You are the Son of God. No one has called himself that. Jesus rarely, if ever, called himself that. But Peter is way, way ahead of the other disciples in this moment. And Jesus recognizes this. He looks at Peter for a second and says, bless your heart, Peter. That was revealed to you by my Father in heaven. There wasn't any human being could have told you that. No one else has said that of me. And then Jesus starts to make cryptic statements about this thing that he's going to build. He says he's going to build a church, an ecclesia, a group of called out ones. And the only people using that term in Jesus' day, ecclesia, the called out ones, were, believe it or not, the Romans. They used it for a military draft, and right around him is an outpost. And whenever there was a draft, they said the citizens, the men were called out from the citizenry into the draft, and they used it for an election. You were called out of your homes and out of your neighborhoods with ballots, and you would cast your ballot in public in the center of the market that was the called out ones. And so Jesus is borrowing a term that had a rich legacy with the empire, and he's using it of something else. He says, I will build my own community of called out ones, and hell will not be able to stop me. Then he says, I will give you the keys to the kingdom so that whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you permit on earth is permitted in heaven. You will have authority that goes far beyond the Romans. But you must not tell anyone who I am. Then, starting then, from that time on, Jesus said that the Son of Man must go to Jerusalem. And it's four times in the original language. He must go to Jerusalem and be handed over. He must suffer and must be killed by the religious leaders and must rise again. This is necessary. This has to happen, he says. And Peter says, God forbid. That'll never happen to you. I've seen what you can do. And Jesus says to Peter, get behind me, Satan. And he doesn't mean get away from me. He means get in behind me. He isn't excommunicating Peter. He's telling Peter to get back in his place, behind me or alongside of me. You're losing your place. You can hear Peter's religion coming apart. They have two entirely different visions of what happens to Christians. Two entirely different visions of God. Peter can't imagine a God who loses to the Romans. Jesus can't imagine a God who doesn't die. Are you seeing what's happening here? This is a critical moment when God starts saying some crazy things. And then Jesus says that the problem is with Peter's mind. And that word, there's a couple words for this, but the word that he uses here doesn't mean his brain. It doesn't mean his thoughts. The word means his default. It means his instincts. It means his bias, the way that he sees the world. And Jesus is saying to Peter, your problem is that you don't see things. You don't see the world the way that God sees them. You see them like a human being sees them. And you will never come to this place where you can get in alongside me until your mind, your defaults, your instincts are changed. Oh, man, I can't stress this enough, how much discipleship is wasted, absolutely wasted on behavior modification. Man, that is, I won't say that. The purpose of discipleship is to change your instincts. Your gut response, the way you act before you have time to think, how should I act? That is the part of you that discipleship wants to change. Anything less than that is conformity to the masses. And you can settle for that if you want to, but do you know this morning so much more is possible? God can change your inner mind so that you have entirely different value systems. You don't even like the stuff you used to like. You just have different desires. And I know that seems for some of you like it's a long ways off, like, oh man, maybe in the next life. Why do you keep putting off for heaven? What Jesus says is possible now. He speaks as though it is possible now. Say that you can't do it. Say that your situation's different. But don't say that it's not possible. Are you there? It is here at the crossroads where Jesus and, well, Peter finds himself in between his vision of how this kingdom thing works, how this Christian life works, and then what Jesus is saying, and he's talking nonsense. And Jesus says, everything is different in God's mind for you. This is unacceptable, but for God, this is necessary. For you, this is the loss of life, but for God, it is his greatest moment. For you, it is all cross, and for God, it is all glory. In the cross. Then Jesus, like, moves the vision out even higher and says, he's not any longer talking about himself. He's now talking about us, because the word he uses is anyone and whoever. He says, yes, anyone who wants to be my disciple must deny himself, take up his cross. Not Jesus's, yours, as if there is something already in front of you, already upon you that you cannot carry. You must take that up and walk with it alongside of Jesus. You must deny yourself your right to self-invent, self-determine, self-actualize, self-preserve. You must let go of it. You have to understand how counterintuitive this is. For some people, this feels like absolute suicide. If I do that, I might as well be dead. Jesus says, if you do that, you're starting to live. Do you know how free you could be this morning if you were not so obsessed with self-image? You could walk into a conversation, any conversation, and you could say things freely, and you would never have to drive home wondering what you looked like, what they were thinking of you. You could be so absorbed in the moment with another person that you wouldn't have to think about your own situation. Can you imagine being in a movie where you are not the star? And this takes many different forms. I've already said this. I don't want to belabor it. It's just that if you think getting old takes this away, it doesn't. Sometimes you just get old. But what used to be competition and networking in your 30s becomes in your 60s and 70s your reputation and your legacy. Same problem, I think. I think there's two things that have to happen in order to inch our way out of this. I'll frame it like this. If this hasn't happened to you yet, God bless you. I am happy for you. I really am. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news. But eventually, you will come to a place in life where God starts misbehaving. He starts saying things or calling for things which seem to you irrational. And you could not in a million years imagine that a good God would tolerate this, let alone call for it. He will lead you. He will lead you into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. He will do this. There will be a crisis, a dark night of the soul, and you will hear the timbers in your faith start to rattle. You'll start thinking you're losing it. You don't know what to believe anymore. If God cannot be like that, then it's like he can't be at all. But you know that every image you have of God, he must, in mercy, shatter. When you were at that place, you're in Caesarea Philippi. Jesus will say, this is the new definition of follow. What it meant in Matthew 4 just meant, come on, we're going to evangelize the world. But what it means here in Matthew 16 is, the road is narrow and it's getting harder, and I need you to stay with me. In that crisis where it feels like you're losing everything and you want to negotiate with God, I think these two things are necessary. One is an utter surrender to what is happening or not happening in your life right now. And as long as you complain and threaten or blame yourself, I just deserve this, or you analyze it, what is the meaning of this? Part of the problem is there is no meaning. The meaning was never the point. Never the point. The point is loyalty here, now, even in this. Are you there? We will have to surrender to what is obviously inevitable. We will have to accept it, have to embrace it as a sacrament. It comes as a sacrament. It is here in this God is giving me himself in a beautiful new way. I just hate the wrappings. The second thing I think we must do in that moment or that season is to re-up. I think we have to go back to God and say, even though none of this makes sense, and even though I don't like it, and I have some serious questions about you, I can't leave. And you will think, well, what exactly am I holding on to? You won't know. But if you will not let go, I promise you, you will make the rest of that journey with God. And there will be a bonding between you and God like no other place in your life. And those of you that have been through Caesarea Philippi, you know what I'm talking about.